You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. Peter Miguel Cameo was born December 31, 1939, and died on Saturday, September 13, 2008, in his home with his family at his side. Today we'll listen to a selection of voices from Peter Cameo's memorial, held at International House in Berkeley on November 23rd. We can only pay a fraction of the over two-hour memorial that chronicles Peter's many activities in the political and social activist arenas, his leadership in the socially responsible investment movement, and his decades constantly pushing the envelope and striving to do things that had never been done before. Peter Cameo was relentless in calling out financial and political elites for engineering the decades-long course of ever-increasing concentration of wealth and power our country suffers from today. He promoted the idea of a brokerage firm being the financial wing of the next great social movement, and his vision included the day when environmental and economic justice takes precedence over corporate greed. Among the many recognizing the passing of a comrade, colleague, mentor, and good friend are those from the 70s through the 90s, when Peter founded North Star and then Progressive Asset Management, those working on environmental issues, Dr. Aga Said from the American Muslim Alliance, Gus Horowitz, Alan Hicks, Kathy Cartier, and Eric Leeson, Martin Sanchez, City of Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin, Gilman Stein, Jason West, Peter Cration, Barbara Becknell, Ramon Cordona, and Alicia Mendoza of El Salvador. I'm airing Peter's wife, Marella, his brother, Tony, as well as Ralph Nader, Matt Gonzalez, Donna Warren, and Leslie Evans, who describes Peter's autobiography finished just before his death. If you'd like a copy of the full event, email me at susan@raisingsandradio. And thanks to Harold Adler for sharing his audio recording for this show.
So my name is Claudette Bégin, and Peter called me a few months ago to say that he had cancer again. And would I do his memorial if it came to that? Gulp, I thought. Of course, thinking it's not going to be a small job to honor such a man. And so it did come to that, and we're here today. And I know many of you have known him well or have been inspired by him. And we hope that you get inspiration out of today's memorial. And so here is Marella and the family.
Well, good afternoon. Our family and I would like to welcome you today. This memorial, as Claudette said, was his idea. He started planning it with Claudette a while back. And I had overheard his conversations. And when he finally decided to bring it up to me, I suggested not to wait until he was gone, but to go ahead and celebrate his life, to plan a get-together with all of you, his friends from the past and present, and enjoy your company and the many, many memories that you've shared together. He would be telling you all sorts of stories and future projects. If you knew him, you knew he couldn't stop coming up with new ideas. His mind was restless. He was forever thinking about the future, and he would, and we would be listening with interest to what he had to say about this exciting and convoluted time. His thoughts would be mostly optimistic, but he would be invariably thinking about the future generations and how to make a better world for them. He would be telling stories about his family, his kids and grandkids. It gave him so much joy to watch their soccer games or brag about their school achievements. He'd be telling you how proud he was of Daniel, who on election day, he was the only one in his fifth grade class to vote Nader Gonzalez. And Andrew, who would love to sneak up on him every Thursday morning to say, "Hi, Papa," when he was immersed in a phone conversation with one of you, invariably making him jump out of his chair. Or of the great joy and love and contentment he experienced every time he held baby Oliver in his arms. And Sarah, where's Sarah? Sarah and Daniel, Liz?
We're here.
Oh, there they are. Okay. And Sarah, the boy's new cousin, the only girl in the family, and how much he liked watching them play hide and seek throughout the house. Because of your presence, Peter is here with us today. Each one of you has brought a part of him in your hearts and memories. For this, I thank you all very much. As for me, I just can't imagine life without Peter. There's one more thing I would like to share with you, and it's that the political section of the UC Davis Library will be the next home for Peter's books. There you'll be able to find not only his book collection, but recordings, videos that were made of him throughout his campaigns and many of his personal memorabilia. Thank you all for coming.
So the next person who is going to speak is Tony Cameo. That is his brother, and here he is.
Even though Peter and I were many miles apart geographically later in life, and even drifted apart politically on some issues, not all, we still remain close. We were only 2 years apart, which of course as children is huge, but as teenagers we were much closer and played Sunday league soccer together. He played left inside and I played left outside. All the Cameo boys are left-handed, something we inherited from our paternal grandmother. Our aunts used to tell us that as little kids, whenever we would come over to our grandmother's house in Barquisimeto, in Venezuela, our cousins would yell, "Aquí vienen los Pedritos," which means, "Here come the Peters," which gives you an idea of who the troublemaker was. In high school, he got into argument with the varsity soccer coach because he told Peter that he shouldn't be hanging around with certain friends, Maurice and Van, because they were Chinese. Peter was furious and caused such an uproar at the school that from then on, it was commented in Great Neck, where we went to school, that people either hated or loved the Cameos. No one was indifferent. The assistant varsity coach later became my coach, maintaining the same animosity towards me, and one day used a flimsy excuse to kick me off the team after telling me that I had been nominated for All-Scholastic by an overwhelming majority of the high school soccer coaches on Long Island, but that too bad because I wouldn't be getting the award. I probably should go back to Great Neck and claim that award because it really should go to Peter, who was a much better player than I was. Peter engaged in politics with an intellectual enthusiasm that drew in everyone around him. His world was not only the world of ideas, it was also the world of action to right the wrongs of society. He never had any interest in material things when he was young. He had absolutely no idea what clothes he was wearing, or if it was my shirt he had taken. To him, it was all irrelevant. There were more important things to think about. I don't believe Peter ever had color-coordinated clothes until he married Morella. We used to joke that Peter would give you the shirt off his own back even if it wasn't his shirt. But there was something else about Peter. He was fearless. Now, in the 1950s, this was unusual, especially among red diaper babies, the kids of parents who had been active in radical politics in the 1930s. We had just been through the McCarthy hearings, and parents would tell their kids, "Be careful what you say," for fear of reprisal from the FBI or from employers. There's a great parody of the McCarthy era by a group of Canadian actors called The Investigators. Some of you may have heard it. And Peter, Danny, my older brother, and I would sit together with friends, and we would play these records over and over again, listening to them. In fact, I memorized the entire record. Those of you who have never heard it, it's available. You can look it up on the internet. It's a fantastic parody and has so much to do with what's going on today in many respects. The fact that Peter was not afraid to speak his mind drew a lot of respect among his peers during those school days and inspired them to speak out as well. The conservatism of the 1950s was thawing, and students were being inspired by the movement to ban nuclear weapons, the civil rights movement, and then the Cuban Revolution. The latter was the single most radicalizing event of our generation, and that radicalization spread to hundreds of thousands of young people with the escalation of the war in Vietnam. Now, as all of you know and witness today, Peter was an excellent speaker and a brilliant debater. While I was at Tufts and Peter was at MIT, I convinced the head of the debate team to organize an event on the pros and cons of the Cuban Revolution so that students could hear both sides of the issue. We put Peter up against a young Republican. Of course, in those days, colleges were very conservative and being pro-Cuba was not very popular. Well, after the debate, the head of the debate team came over to me and said, "I disagreed with everything your brother said, but he won the debate hands down." Peter inspired that kind of respect for his sharp wit and ideas, even among those who disagreed with him. Morella was moved when Governor Schwarzenegger sent flowers to the house and called her personally to express his and Maria's condolences the day after Peter's death. When Peter ran for mayor of Berkeley in the 60s, the Berkeley Gazette, which was run by a moderate or conservative Mike Colbert, ran an editorial stating that the Republican candidate was the most qualified, but that Peter was the most honest. Peter, who scored 800 on his college, his math college board exams, had a very quick mind and a great sense of humor. Some of you may remember a Vietnam War teaching right here at UC Berkeley in 67, I believe, where Peter debated another young Republican. Halfway into the debate, the pro-Vietnam War student started red-baiting Peter. "Well, of course you're for the Viet Cong. You're a Marxist." So Peter, not one to be intimidated by red-baiting, fired back, "And what do you know about Marx? Have you ever read any of his books?" And the young Republican answered, "Yes, I have." Peter pressed on, "Have you read Das Kapital?" And his opponent replied, "Yes, I have." "All four volumes?" Peter continued, "Yes, all four volumes." His opponent replied, rather annoyed by now. So Peter, smiling quickly, added, "Well, that's very good because he only wrote three." Of course, the audience burst out into laughter and applause, and needless to say, they now listen with interest to the substance of his speech. Peter's oratory skills and quick mind, which some say he got from his paternal grandfather, Daniel Camejo Acosta, a doctor and a great orator, and from his maternal great-grandfather, Juan de Dios Huanche, a revered educator, Venezuelan educator, came into play over and over again throughout his life. During the Battle of Telegraft, inspired by the student revolt in France in May of 1968, the YSA organized a sympathy rally, which was illegally broken up by the Berkeley police on the premise of us not having a permit to block the street, even though the street was never blocked. You will enjoy reading about these events in great detail in Peter's upcoming autobiography. Peter's role was critical. There are two brief moments I want to share which changed the tone and direction of important meetings and therefore the outcome of events. There were various political tendencies that wanted to take the movement in different directions. You had the liberals who didn't want to confront the city council, and then you had some ultra-lefts who had no confidence whatsoever that we could win over the people of Berkeley to support our right of freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. At one mass meeting, not far from here, with some 2,000 people, mainly students, one person got up and gave a heated speech, which ended with, "Let's go trash Shattuck Avenue!" And everybody answered, "Yeah!" So, you know. Peter then took the mic, and everyone quieted down, and you could feel the energy in the room. Students were angry about the police attack. They wanted to do something dramatic to get back at the authorities. They wanted action, but what kind of action would be effective? Peter, picking up on the explosiveness of the mood, began his speech. "You know, in a revolution, there are certain things that you say, but you don't do, and there are other things that you don't say, but you do." "Right on," was the response from the audience. Having disarmed the people who wanted to break windows as a form of protest, he then explained how we had to mobilize the entire community to win our right of assembly, that we had to confront the council politically, and that we should mobilize a mass turnout to the next council meeting to demand our right to peacefully assemble on Telegraph Avenue. At first, we only succeeded in getting a permit to hold a rally on a side residential street to build support for what we really wanted. At that rally, which included a rock band, there were many speakers. One of the first speakers took the mic and said, "Please, let's not make too much noise. We don't want to alienate people." That was too much for Peter. Peter grabbed the mic and said, "Noise? We're just beginning to make noise." The crowd cheered their approval, and of course the story is we mobilized the entire community with thousands packed into a special council meeting, and we won the right to assemble and speak at our very own July 4th celebration on Telegraph Avenue. This was a model of how to build mass support for a basic right. Peter's leadership and speaking ability were critical to that success, along with a dedicated political organization behind him at that time, the YSA and the SWP. Peter was an optimist to the very end. He firmly believed that we could rally the support of the majority of the American people to just causes, and that you had to use every legal and peaceful means to achieve those ends. He understood the importance of using elections to raise issues that the two major parties would not because of their allegiance to big moneyed interests. Thus his support for the Green Party and his participation in numerous election campaigns. Ralph Nader was very gracious in referring to Peter as a great American. But I am sure Ralph would agree that Peter was much more. He was a great citizen of the world. And he cared as deeply about modern-day slavery and genocide in Africa as he did about protecting the environment or the rights of a migrant worker enticed into the U.S. by agribusiness, as we saw from his speech, and then demonized for asking for basic human rights and dignity. Later in his life, Peter discovered the world of brokerage and finance. I remember him calling me from his introductory course at Merrill Lynch. And he says, "Tony, you're not going to believe this." And I said, "What, Peter?" He says, "Did you know that you can buy stocks without even having the money?" And then he said, "But wait, it gets even better. You can sell a stock you don't even own." If only today's regulators had paid attention to his observation. Peter applied his math ability to the brokerage business and became a whiz at options trading. But at Merrill, he did something much more important. He launched the first socially screened fund at a major brokerage house, the Ecological Trust. Soon, however, as Merrill reneged on the deal they had negotiated, he learned what some have called the difference between a pig and an investment banker. There are certain things even a pig won't do. If you need to understand why socially responsible investing is not only crucial but outperforms over the long run, you need only look at Merrill Lynch. The leadership of that firm drove it into the ground, concerned not for its clients or the many good people who worked there, but primarily for their bonuses. It is not that they were stupid. It is that they were corrupt, along with being stupid. And you can add Washington to that bunch. The current financial crisis shows that this is not simply the lack of regulations that is the problem. My God, the regulatory manuals are thousands of pages thick. It is having the wrong regulations combined with the refusal to enforce the correct ones because of the conflict of interest of campaign contributions to the very regulators that are supposed to be protecting the public good. So after a not-so-good experience with ethical standards at Merrill, Peter decided to go out on his own and created the first broker-dealer dedicated to SRI, Progressive Asset Management. And you will hear from Kathy Carter and Eric Leeson, who worked closely with him during this important part of his life. And how we would like to have Peter and hear his opinion today, right now, on this financial crisis. He would probably be joking about how the Bush administration had embraced socialism, at least for their cronies, and that, I guess, the free markets are only for the little people. Early this year, as Peter struggled with cancer, he was still optimistic about the future when he decided to join forces with me and my partners. He encapsulated what he wanted to do next in the financial markets with the slogan, "Catch the Wave, the Future of Investing, Renewable Energy, Conservation, a Sustainable Planet." This was his vision. When his cancer came back, I began dreading that I would not only lose my closest brother, but that I would also lose someone who inspired me politically and intellectually. I wanted to know so much more about the evolution of his ideas from those early Berkeley days to the present. When I visited Peter in Folsom this past June, I asked him, I said, "Peter, after all your experiences of your politically active life, what is your conclusion about the type of society we should aspire to? Look at what happened in the Soviet Union with the loss of 20 million lives due to the forced collectivization under Stalin. Was that a worker state? Was it worth 20 million innocent lives? We now know that Stalin even turned over Jewish Bolsheviks to Hitler as part of the Stalin-Hitler pact. How can you have a progressive society that bans the internet, one of the most democratizing inventions in human history? Shouldn't the right to travel be a basic human right? What about the rights of the individual versus the rights of groups or social classes? Couldn't politicians be considered a new social class with interests very different from those who elected them? What should be an ideal society? What conclusions have you reached?" And Peter turned to me with a serious face and said, "You ask me this now, 15 minutes before lunch?" Well, you will have to wait for Peter's autobiography for a fuller answer. But he did tell me one thing. He said, "What really matters is to stay engaged and involved at whatever level, wherever you see injustice. Join with others to continue fighting for a better world. Labels don't matter. It is not what you call yourself. It is what you do that counts, whether it is protecting the environment or righting social and political wrongs. Be suspicious of the cult of the individual. Too often, political movements become cults run by cliques that lose sight of the need to involve large numbers of people by winning them over, not coercing them, to accomplish worthy social ends. Work together where you agree. Agree to disagree on other issues. It is through struggle on specific causes and issues that we make progress towards a better world." Perhaps I heard what I wanted to hear, but one thing is certain. Peter remained true to his ideals to his last breath. You may have disagreed with some of those ideas, but you had to respect his tenacity and his belief that it was the goodness of his fellow human beings that would prevail in the end. We will sorely miss the sharp wit and the fearless fighter that was Peter Camejo. Thank you for honoring his memory with your presence.
This is Raising San Radio and KZSU Stanford. I'm Susan Gallimore, bringing you voices from Peter Camejo's memorial in Berkeley, November 28th. Coming up is Ralph Nader.
On behalf of our colleagues in Washington who knew and loved Peter, our deepest sympathies to Morella and Camejo family. There's no recovery from this loss. The only recovery, and it doesn't rise to the magnitude, is to preserve his legacy. It's ironic, isn't it, that this gathering is at the University of California, Berkeley, because Peter was expelled from the University of California, Berkeley. He was expelled for unauthorized use of a bullhorn. Not a very scholarly rationale. I'd like to just go through what can we learn from Peter Camejo and his life, because I know he never really liked a lot of praise. He was so result-oriented, and I asked myself, well, what would Peter like to have said here? I'm going to go through what I think are the lessons of his stay on Earth and his commitment to justice, which is the great work of human beings on Earth. And he reflected that every hour that he lived. The ancient philosopher Heraclitus once said, "Character is destiny." And I would add, "Personality is decisive." Peter Camejo had the perfect blend of those two. You cannot do what he did for so many years without burning out or becoming discouraged or becoming alienated unless you have an adaptable character and personality suited to confronting abuses of power. One might call it the civic personality. The first thing to learn from Peter is he was multidimensional. To know Peter is never to know him fully. You're always discovering everything that he did, and then he always did more. He never specialized, and I think that's what gave him the framework and the span of his interests around the world, up and down the hemisphere and around the globe. He was an advocate, a polemicist, a scholar, a candidate for public office, my vice presidential running mate in 2004. He was a person who changed careers, going into socially responsible investments. He was a many-splendored human being. The second thing he taught us was he was principled. Now, it's easy to use that word if commitment to principle is not tempted by expediency or opportunism or material gain. He was the reverse of Oscar Wilde, who once said that he could resist everything but temptation. Peter could resist temptation. It's hard to explain running with a person for president who you never had to worry about on the political and economic issues. And Matt Gonzalez was like that too. But in testing the principal, you test whether they have a favorite choice of victims. And Peter didn't have a favorite choice of victims. And he didn't ignore other victims where he might have been criticized if he did the reverse. For example, unlike a lot of progressives, he didn't sidestep the issue of Palestinian rights. And it would have been very easy to do that. He went into the stock market world and he was never corrupted and never co-opted. In fact, he bent it into his direction, as you will see from his book on socially responsive investing. That's a very detailed book. And that's what was remarkable about him. He was very, very detailed. Thirdly, he had the temperament. I always watched him when he really got excited in front of an audience. He never used foul language. He never described dark motivations, which in some ways upset me. And he was very self-controlled, even though he waved his hands and he was an orator. You could see he was really self-controlled. I once saw him take off against organized religion here at Berkeley. That was the closest I've ever seen him to spin out of control. He had a sense of history, which is rare these days. He had a sense of history. And if you read his book on the Reconstruction era after the Civil War and progressive movements in that incubating period, you would know what I meant. He wanted more than anything else to write a book on the history of the Democratic Party, because his thesis was the Democratic Party was the instrument of suppressing, co-opting, or sidelining fundamental progressive movements for social justice. And that is something which I'm sure a lot of people do. And I think you'll see some of that in his autobiography, but he wanted to devote an entire book to it, and he ran out of time. Fifth is that he was future-oriented. That's very important in terms of persistency against odds and against all kinds of defeats and losses. What it did was it prevented him from being pessimistic and discouraged and burning out and shrinking his frame of reference, because when you're future-oriented, you have a pretty broad frame of reference. Sixth, he always renewed himself, and he was always learning. You know, some people, they sort of learn until they're about 30, and then they run on the fumes for 30, 40 years. And you can see it, and a lot of the politicians are that way. And he was always reading and thinking and talking with people and challenging them. And he believed in intellectual tension. This is why I never bothered him at all to come up against very, very extreme right-wing people in a public venue. He actually relished it. Seventh, he had moral courage. Now, moral courage, in a way, is very rare. It's much rarer than physical courage. General Patton once defined physical courage on the battlefield as fear plus 5 minutes. And moral courage, you have to have it for a long time, because it's retaliation is for a long time. Think what whistleblowers go through, for example. But he told me a story once in a jocular way, but it really was very impressive. He joined the army, and the first hours they took all the recruits through the usual line where they were picking up their clothing, their shoes, their tools, their equipment, their big sack on their back, and as they were all marching through one room after another, they marched through a room where a sergeant was sitting on a desk at a desk. And he was just giving everybody a pen, and he was saying, sign. And it was a statement they had to sign. And Peter said, what's this? You know how he said that? And the sergeant said, sign this. It's a loyalty oath to the U.S. government. And Peter said, that's unconstitutional. And the sergeant said, what did you say? And he said, that violates my constitutional rights of free speech. I'm not going to sign it. The sergeant said, would you step aside, please? There's someone that wants to talk with you. And they drummed him out of the army, even though he wanted to stay in. There aren't many people who would do that. What was he? A late teenager at the time. So he paid a price for his moral courage in many ways. But he was very courageous in his illness. In all the hours I spoke to him on the phone, he never demonstrated any self-pity. And the last time Matt and I called him, which was probably September 10th or so, we got him on the phone, and he said in an irregular voice, he said, I can't talk to you guys now. I'll talk to you later. Those are his last words to us. But that's the only slight shudder that I saw him express. And can you imagine the condition he was in, even to say that? He was also resilient. Not many people can engage in that many struggles for justice and still keep coming back with a good attitude and fervor and learning as he goes. Resiliency is one of the rarest traits in a full-time public citizen's career, as we all know, because you wouldn't be here if you weren't active citizens. Ninth, he had a grounded public philosophy. That's very important. He knew who he was, where he came from, where he wanted to go. He was not a windmill, although he loved wind power. He had a compass, and that always impressed me, because that way he could receive a lot of information daily, and it fit in his public philosophy. And his public philosophy was not an ideology. It was not dogmatic. It was a broad framework of what's fair and what's just, given different situations. And, of course, he had a very deep sense of injustice. The jurisprudence professor at NYU many years ago, Edmund Kahn, once said, you cannot have a sense of justice without having a sense of injustice. And he had a very cultivated sense of injustice. And finally, he used his capital. A lot of people don't like to use their influence or their moral capital. And he demonstrated that at the Peace and Freedom Convention about 10 days before he passed away. When he came down with his head shaven, and he was clearly going through chemotherapy hell, And I looked at his eyes when he was sitting in the audience, and it was like nothing was wrong. He was interested and alert. And then he got up and he made a case for Matt and I getting on the Peace and Freedom ballot. And those of you who were there must have known what he was made of. And he really didn't have to do that. Physically, he didn't have to do that. And he, I'm sure, upset some of his friends who supported other candidates. But he took a stand. That's what Peter was all about. He took a stand. He would have agreed with Marcus Cicero's definition of freedom. Marcus Cicero defined freedom as participation in power. And that's what he was all about. Just power, shifting power, recognizing that the concentration of power and greed and control in the hands of the few are the greatest sources of injustice and deprivation and undermining the future for our children and grandchildren. Well, to say that we're going to miss Peter is to engage in a cliche. But I hope through his biography, his legacy will continue in his own words. And I hope through his other books, people will read his revision of history in a more accurate way compared to the way it's taught us. And I hope that by what we continue doing in his spirit and with his example, wherever he is today, he will say to us, I miss you all too. Thank you.
Next is Donna Warren, one of the running mates with Peter, and she's come up from Los Angeles.
It's hard to be here today. I love Peter, I really did. And to follow Ralph Nader is very, very hard. My goodness, don't schedule me like that again, please. I was Peter's lieutenant governor running mate in 2002 and 2006. And before 2002, I didn't know Peter. But in 2002, he came down to Los Angeles and he asked me to be his lieutenant governor running mate. I thought he was crazy. I said, I don't know you. Why are you asking me this? Well, I had run for Congress and I got like three times the votes they thought I should have gotten. And I did stand up for the Palestinians, and I did some things because I believed in them, and I believed in the platform of the Green Party. But here was Peter, who had spent his whole life struggling for American democracy. And in his own right, as you well know, Peter was a great man. But Peter was also a humble man and very approachable. And so this friend of Malcolm X, who Malcolm used to sit in the first row when he preached at the Audubon Auditorium, this man who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., came to me, a nobody. And what he told me was that together, we could bring about a multi-party political system that would bring equity, fairness, truth, and hope to all our communities. All our communities. I followed, supported, and loved this man. In 2006, I don't know if Mr. Nader remembers this, but I wrote a letter to Peter Camejo and to Ralph Nader. Two unreasonable men. This is what I told them. Thank you for all you do for our humanity. When I tell both of you that I love you, I'm not kidding. I love you because you are unreasonable men. And because you are the smartest and most caring people I know. Our world is a better place because you inspire us to fight for truth and justice. Sometimes you get an opportunity to sit in the company of greatness. It's in these times that you find a corner and you sit and you listen. When I was with Peter, I knew I was in the company of greatness. And so I sat and I listened. I was honored to know Peter and to be asked by him to accompany him for a little while on a journey that brought meaning to all our lives. I will miss Peter greatly, but for Marilla, I want to say, even though Peter was a private man, he always gave thanks for the happiness and the serenity you brought to his life. Thank you, Marilla, for being Peter's rock, and thank you, everyone, for being here today to honor my friend, Peter Camejo.
Next is Matt Gonzalez.
Every time I started to try to jot down some things I wanted to say for this event, you know, I wrote down the same sentence to start off. I kept writing down, Peter was a beautiful man. And as I think about him, I'm certain that I'm always going to be able to conjure him up and remember him. He would come into my office with a certain swagger and a grin on his face. And it wasn't one of arrogance. It was a boyish way that he came sauntering in and smiling. And he knew that he was in a safe place where he could talk politics, where he was among friends, and it was a welcome event for all of us in the office. When Peter died, I did a number of interviews with the press, and I said, you know, a very major figure of the American left has died. And I noted to myself when I read some of the accounts about his death, there was often the reference to the idea of the perennial candidate, Peter Camejo. And I think embedded in this notion was an effort, perhaps I read more into it than I should, but I think an effort to disparage what it is to run more than once when you don't win the contest. It's as if the question that was being posed was, why do you keep running? What is the point? And I think one thing about Peter that was different than the rest of us is that his politics were informed by his knowledge of Latin America. Of course, we know that the struggle is a long one. But Peter had met with political prisoner that Jason mentioned, Hugo Blanco in Peru, for instance. Here's a peasant leading an uprising. The government nearly kills him. He's imprisoned. And after a revolution, he becomes a senator from his country. So if you have seen governments topple, you're not concerned with whether or not you're getting half a percentage point or 2 or 3 percentage points, because you're building something which is about the consciousness for the future. I'm always going to be able to remember my race for mayor of San Francisco and one event in particular, after having a variety of Democratic Party celebrities come to town and honor me by campaigning against me. Al Gore and all these other folks. Bill Clinton was in town, and of course the media was covering it. They were very interested in it, and they wanted to know what Matt Gonzalez was doing. Well, who was speaking for Matt Gonzalez? I was at a house party on Fillmore Street with Peter Camejo, and he got such a kick out of the interviews because they were, you know, showing Bill Clinton and they're showing Peter Camejo. And I remember putting my arm around him as we were hanging out in front of this house. And I was saying to him, boy, this dichotomy, you know, the difference in candidates couldn't be clearer, huh? Recently, Peter and I, before his most recent bout with cancer, we were in an art studio south of Market at Gustavo Rivera's studio. And Gustavo's a really lovely, elegant man, a painter from Mexico, abstract painter. And he welcomed Peter into his studio, and he's a very avant-garde fellow. So there are many people in his studio. And Peter was eating, and there was a lot of Spanish being spoken and drinking. And eventually I said, "Hey, Peter, let's look at some paintings." And he smiled, you know. And he said to my girlfriend nearby, he says, "Oh, I knew he was going to do this." Because I always tried to get him to look at art. I'd ask him, "When was the last time you bought a painting?" And he'd smile and he'd say, "Oh, Morella's the one that likes paintings." So we sat him down in a chair in front of this great big abstract painting. I mean, this is a world-class painter. And we're sitting there, and I'm trying to explain to him, "Look, Peter, this is a very radical thing. I mean, imagine, painting goes from, you know, religious depictions to paintings of the aristocracy, and look at the wild canvas. Look at this non-objective, radical thing going on." And he sat, and he looked, and he says, "What do you guys see in that?" And we said, "Well, it's abstract. What do you see in it?" And he paused, and he said, "Well, I see Ireland." And we all started laughing, right? Ireland? What is he talking about? But he wanted there to be some way for him to ground himself in what he was looking at. And I think it's what he did in politics. You know, late in his life, you heard somebody mention there was this, the point, I think his brother made the point, this idea that he was very concerned that labels were interfering with our cause. He felt that they put labels on us so that they don't have to debate our ideas. And in a way, he felt our politics were far more grounded than this. There was nothing that we believed in that we shouldn't already have. There was nothing that we were trying to accomplish that was radical. I had the opportunity in very late June, I think it was, the last weekend in June, it was before the Peace and Freedom Party convention. Robin and I went to see Peter at his home in Folsom, and I think Morella was away because the grandson was just born, and Peter was playing host to Robin and I, and we got to go swimming with him, and we talked about some things. And he talked about his desire not to die as a member of the Green Party. He also talked about writing his memoirs. And it was very interesting because we had had these conversations a number of times. He was, I think, a lucky man to know that he might die and get to look at his life and sort of tinker with it and kind of probe it and wonder whether or not he had made the right choices, not just in politics, but in his personal life. And it wasn't because he was unhappy with where he was. It was simply a man looking over his shoulder. And in my own case, I feel that during those conversations, he was the younger man, because I would be the one saying to him, "But Peter, you're romanticizing this choice because you didn't make the choice, and so you didn't get to see where it took you." And he didn't want to hear anything about that. And I think it speaks to the effort at closure was also one that allowed for that almost like the other path, the alternative route. And I think his memoirs convey that sense of questioning about his own political choices. The last conversation, Ralph mentioned it briefly, but we were in Ohio. We were at the end of a tour in the Midwest. We had been in five or six different states, and periodically we'd be in a car, and Matt Zawiski would be driving, and Ralph would turn to me and say, "Have you called Peter? Have you heard from Peter?" And so in Ohio, we finally got Peter on the phone, and he had left me a message in a very distressed voice, essentially saying he didn't think he was going to make it this time. And we spoke to him, we spoke to Morella, and we spoke to Peter. And, you know, I said to Peter in that conversation, I said, first I said, "Look, Peter, keep fighting." You know, Morella had shared with us that he was in a lot of pain and he wanted to give up. I said, "Keep fighting. You know, this pain is going to subside. This is just part of the treatment. And if you can just get through the next couple of days, just try to do that." And then I said, "You know, Peter, if it's your time to go, then so be it. There's nothing we can do about that, then it's simply your time. But I said to him, I said, Peter, you have a lot to be proud of. I said, you have fought and committed your life to the cause of social justice and equality. I said, you never capitulated as so many of your comrades of earlier days did. And I said, we love you. And when I said we, I meant Ralph and I, of course, but I also meant we in the sense of this larger community, those who had worked with him, those who knew him, those who benefited from his efforts. I am quite confident that in my own life, the politics that I engage in will continue to be informed by Peter Camejo. I think of him not only in my travels with Ralph Nader, but in other political struggles that I'm already thinking about and already conjuring up. I know that Peter's going to be with me, and he will be alive as long as I am alive and engaged in that work. And I hope that you do the same thing. Thank you.
Leslie Evans is next, who is the editor for Peter's autobiography.
I first met Peter when he was 23 and I was 20 years old, and he came on a speaking tour for the Young Socialist Alliance to Los Angeles. A few years later, I was an editor in the party's national office of the Socialist Workers' Party, and Peter was a frequent writer for the party press. So he and I established an editorial relationship going all the way back to the late 60s. And then there were years where I didn't see so much of Peter, where we were both, in effect, thrown out of the party, and where Peter went on to the North Star Network, to his election campaigns, to Progressive Asset Management. And I would see him occasionally over the years. In April, Peter called me. I knew he had cancer. It was in remission at that time, and he had hopes it would stay that way. But he was working on his autobiography, and he wanted to know if I, and I was a professional editor at UCLA for a long time, would I edit the book for him. I agreed, and Peter sent me the first four chapters. It was some really amazing stuff. The first chapter is this whole event in Cali, Colombia, where the CIA is attempting to arrest him, and the airport staff figure out who he is, and they hide him. The second chapter is his experiences in Peru as he goes to visit the imprisoned Peruvian peasant leader Hugo Blanco, where he smuggles several thousand dollars in to the prisoners. Very interesting stories, all of us there. Then he goes into all the stuff that happened when he came out to Berkeley in the anti-war movement. There's all kinds of events on Telegraph Avenue where he's on a balcony with a loudspeaker. The stairs are barricaded. The police are trying to break in the door. This happened two or three times. Peter was a hero of the People's Park movement in December of 1969 or October. There was the famous anti-draft demonstrations in Oakland where Peter was one of the initiators of what were called mobile tactics, where the demonstrators would throw trash cans behind them and try to stop the police. And that one incident actually was quite successful. Peter talks a lot about the anti-war movement, where this small radical organization was extraordinarily successful. I mean, it was a group that had 400 people in it when he and I joined. He joined a little earlier than I did. And it, in effect, was the linchpin of the American anti-war movement, the group that held the biggest demonstrations, that was the key to a demonstration of 800,000 people in Washington in November of 1969. The SWP, almost in a certain way, because others left it, became captured the largest student anti-war organization in the country of those years. The Student Mobilization Committee with 100,000 members. It showed what a very tiny organization could do, made a huge impact on American politics. The next chapters of Peter's book are a very difficult period. The organization, when the war was over, retreated into general isolation of the left and turned on itself in the miniature way that happened with the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, and it happened in this little organization of a couple of thousand people. And the leadership in New York began to try to exclude and get rid of potential rivals, people who didn't agree with him 100%, and Peter was one of the first victims of that. And he goes through this very traumatic experience. Even when he was chosen for presidential candidate in 76, the central party leadership by that time, he says, hated him. But Peter was the candidate the ranks wanted, so they put him up. But in many ways, he says, they sabotaged his campaign. And there's an interesting story there after that. It's 5 years before Peter is finally, through a very underhanded measure, thrown out of the party. And I was thrown out the year after that, and there are probably some other people here that happened to them too, I imagine. The issue is you create loyalties. You have people you think you agree with. You've worked with them for 20 years, and suddenly they turn on you. And Peter, some of the interesting chapters in Peter's book are why he stayed in for 5 years after he saw this already beginning to develop. He knew it was already happening. But when it happened, he picked himself up, he created the North Star Network, he went on to his election campaigns, to the Progressive Asset Management. Peter sent me a chapter pretty much every week. We started, he had 4 chapters. By the week before he died, he had gotten up to 28 chapters, and he completed his book. He wrote furiously, he had no time to check things, he wrote as fast as he could just to get it on paper. On email. It all went by email to me. I would get a chapter, this huge chapter every week that Peter had knocked out on the latest, section of his life. Peter's grammar tended to be something halfway between English and Spanish. Anyone who's ever worked with Peter's written stuff, as opposed, you can communicate verbally that way, but when you write it down, it needs rather a lot of work to turn it into the kind of stuff that you want to finally put into print. So he and I would have these long talks about it, and then, of course, as Matt said, you never got Peter on the phone without expecting a 40-minute talk about everything in the world and world history and everything else. Peter has 2 key ideas apart from his own life story here. One of them is sort of his explanation of what happened to the Socialist Workers' Party. He says that it was too Russian-focused, it was too alien to American culture, that it was too... all of its symbols were the symbols of some ancient revolution in some other country. That a movement in America has to be an American movement. He was very impressed with Causa R in Venezuela. He got to know those people, he went there, he talked to them. It was a very Venezuelan movement, not built around all kinds of ancient Marxist slogans from Germany in the 1840s. And it was very successful. And that's a message he tries to convey, that and the idea of building an independent electoral movement outside of the 2 monopolistic parties. Those are 2 key things that he wanted to convey that a big part of his memoir is about. Finally, he finished. He finished his book. I got the last of it on Friday before he died the following Tuesday. He took right down to the wire, but he completed the book. And the book has been accepted for publication by Haymarket Books in Chicago. Let me close by reading to you from the last page of Peter's book. This is what the very last thing he had to say as he closed off. Peter says, "We all die. For people who become committed to the idea of creating social justice and peace on our planet, the worst part about death is you do not get to see how the movie ends. Of course, it never really ends, but it does have phases. I began this chapter by saying the world is now changing very fast. Space does not permit me to comment on what this can mean for humans several hundred years from now. There's no doubt in my mind that the world is about to change faster than it ever has. So will humans. It's inevitable. How would science and social change will interrelate is very difficult to foresee. But the need to end the rule of a tiny minority of wealth and to establish democracy is so essential to make sure science is used to benefit our planet and not to destroy it. As I explained at the beginning, I want to dedicate this book to the thousands upon thousands of people who have worked with me through the years for peace, social justice, against racism, and for human rights. I know that future generations will build on what we have done, and if we could only live to see it, we would be so proud. Part of the great joy of life is to be around and see children growing. This obviously comes from our genetic makeup. Deep down, I believe there is a link to why we want to see justice in the world and why so many humans make personal sacrifices for progressive change. It's tied to our instinctual and overriding feeling of paternalism to children. So in a way, I want to dedicate this book to the children, the future participants who will make the third American Revolution a reality.
And that's our show for today. Again, if you'd like a copy of the full event, email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org.